Wow.
Tastes like chicken.
Tastes like chicken.
Very crunchy, like chips and stuff like that.
They actually don't taste like crickets.
Hello and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. What you heard there might well be your Christmas dinner in a few years' time. Keep listening to find out what those lucky people were tasting, why it might just save the world. We also tell you about a new treasure trove of data showing just how much federal stimulus checks have boosted the spending of Black and Hispanic families and how inflation and a slower economy could take them back to square one. But first, tune in, drop out, lie flat. Their parents may have worked 12-hour days for decades supporting China's breakneck economic growth, but a growing number of young people in this famously industrious nation would rather not work at all. You could say it was the Asian counterpart to the Great Resignation that has business executives scratching their heads in the US and Europe. But the lie flat movement also tells us quite a lot about how Chinese society has changed. And it could even put the government's grand plans for the future at risk. In a minute, I'll discuss all of that with Bloomberg Opinion columnist Shuli Ren. But first, here's our Hong Kong-based China economy reporter, Tom Hancock.
In what has been branded as the Great Resignation, US workers are quitting their jobs in record numbers. More than 24 million did so from April to September this year. Millions have dropped permanently out of the labor force, and similar trends are being seen in parts of Europe. But even in China, where coronavirus has been kept largely under control and the economy has doubled in size in the last decade, people are having similar feelings. The country's Lie Flat movement, jump-started by a social media post, is also about opting out. It's a reaction against a system in which a grueling 996 work schedule, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week, is common in industries like technology. So is unrelenting pressure from family, society, and even the government to keep climbing the ladder. In October, thousands of employees at Chinese tech giants, including Alibaba Group and the owner of TikTok, groused about their long work hours in an online campaign called Workers' Lives Matter. And it's not just a white-collar phenomenon. In the southern city of Shenzhen, migrant workers from the countryside, once celebrated for being willing to work tough jobs in manufacturing, are rejecting manual jobs and sometimes prefer to spend their time playing online games, picking up day jobs as needed. Some see parallels between lie flat sentiment in China and similar ideas that emerged in Japan in the 1990s after its economic growth slowed sharply, suggesting China might be facing impending Japan-style stagnation. But others argue it's more like the 1960s-style counterculture movements that cropped up in the US and Europe in a period of affluence, with ordinary people seeking a lower-pressure society that's more focused on personal development than material success. That's the view of Chen Ziyang, a 25-year-old who lives in Shenzhen while studying for a master's degree online.
The society need more definition about success. All the people around you are doing so well, or you're all competing for the same job or for the same kind of success. So you kind of like fear you are gonna left out. So some people just give up.
Even though China, the US and Europe are very different economies, we can connect China's lying flat discussion with the concept of the Great Resignation in developed countries, says Xiang Biao, director of the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology in Germany. Both are about questioning the pursuit of wealth at an individual and a social level.
They emerge at the same time, and we can make a connection and even link them to bigger ideas, such as degrowth, such as sustainability. And this is somehow all related, because it is about overheating, about a society become excessively competitive and just not sustainable, not only in terms of environmental extraction, but also the mental, the mental balance is not sustainable.
Among the new dropouts is Milena Kula, a 26-year-old from Germany who lost her job at the height of the pandemic last year. She has chosen to set up an environmentally sustainable commune in the countryside rather than seeking full-time work.
Am I enough just the way I am? Or do I constantly need new equipment, new material, new goods in my life, new experiences to feel full in some form? So that's something that really changed here.
In developed countries, pressure has been building for decades. Incomes have stagnated, job security has become precarious, and the costs of housing and education have soared, making it harder to build a financially stable life. Milena's story indicates how the pandemic has sometimes converted those simmering concerns into action. Will the Great Resignation and Lie-Flat have a longer-term impact? While they are a challenge to conventional ideas about work and consumption, Xiang Biao points out that they seem to lack specific demands about how to change society. Many will be waiting to see if those ideas emerge. For Bloomberg News, I'm Tom Hancock in Hong Kong.
So I wanted to talk a bit more about lying flat and what it tells us about China's future with Bloomberg opinion columnist Shuli Ren in Hong Kong. Shuli, welcome to Stephanomics. I love the opening line of a column you wrote the other day. China's young people are stressed out. I mean, there are concrete forces making young people's lives more stressful in China, and the Lie Flat movement is just one reaction to that. So tell us more.
Absolutely, Stephanie. After the Chinese government's big tech and big real estate developer crackdown, that actually ruined a lot of the job prospects for China's young people, especially those fresh university graduates. I mean, China has been churning out about 10 million university graduates every year. And in the past, they already struggled to find good jobs. And now the jobs are even fewer than before. And then in the graduating class of 2020, only one third decided to go into the job market, with another third saying, oh, I'm just going to try to, go on to grad school. Because, when there's a recession, everyone applies for grad school, right? So some young people, they just say, oh, I'm just going to take some time off, lie on my parents' couches and figure out what they want to do.
And I guess one of the things that's happening is that, China's getting richer as a country, and now it can have dropouts just the way that, the US had dropouts in the 60s.
Absolutely. I mean, being able to lie flat, to be honest, is a luxury good, right? And also the cost of consumption for a lot of young people is coming down. China's Gen Z, just elsewhere in US and in the UK, they don't need very much money. They spend a lot of time on the internet, right? Surfing on the internet chat rooms and playing video games. It doesn't cost very much money. So they don't need to really earn that much. So they can afford it in a way. And also the parents, China has this major only child policy, right? So the parents will be like, oh, that's my baby. And what can I do? I have to let them lie flat.
I want to get on with how the government's responded. But before I get to that, I wanted to ask you about young women facing particular challenges in this labor force. Tell us a bit more about that.
So the best jobs for young women are in the services industry, such as financial industry, and the media industry. And then in China, as in South Korea, young people apply for jobs, they oftentimes are asked to attach a photo of themselves, right? So young women start to feel that, if I look better, that makes me look a little bit more presentable. So a lot of them start to do a lot of plastic surgery, like facelifts, nose jobs, so on and so forth, which is quite awful. A while back, I also wrote about aesthetics medicine in China, and most of the demand don't come from older women, but from 18 to 24 year olds. And it has become such a problem. And then basically a facelift costs a lot of money, and they don't have money for that, right? So there are e-commerce websites such as Alibaba that give young women so-called consumer loans to do those aesthetics medicine procedures. And then the government is calling a stop to that. They said that the companies can no longer sell asset-backed securities, which are backed by facelift loans.
Unbelievable. It's clearly alarming, I would think, for China's government that has such big plans to lead the world in several critical industries and become bigger and better and more skilled as a nation, to have young people dropping out like this. I mean, how's the government responded?
I mean, President Xi Jinping is very, very worried. He openly talked about the lying flat problem phenomenon in China. And then in October, so China's the State Council proposed this so-called dual training program. It's essentially the German model. Basically, China thinks that the society is churning out too many fresh university graduates who just don't want to go to the factory floors because they feel like, oh, I did 4 years of undergraduate. Why do I want to go to the manufacturing sector, right? So as a result, they decide to lie flat. And China thinks that society has too many of these people. And they want to have more young people go into a so-called vocational training, you spend a few years learning skills in the school, but also a few more years, doing on-the-job training at the biggest blue chip companies such as Huawei or the China's power grid. And that seems to be their solutions. They want more young people to go into high-end manufacturing that does, electric EV supply chains or chip manufacturing. And China doesn't have enough of that right now.
Is any of that working?
Well, this is just a start. they just proposed this so-called German model in October. One problem is there is a little bit of a stigma when it comes to working on the factory floors. And China's middle-class families, they don't really want their children to go into vocational school training, right? I mean, in the U.S., that hasn't been very successful either. So what the State Council proposed is that, some very high-end vocational schools, they should be able to offer bachelor's degrees as well. So even though you are technically going to, the German model, you will still have a degree. So perhaps that will persuade the China's middle-class families to allow their children to go into this kind of German dual-track training programs.
There's an awful lot of countries that have tried to be more German in particularly this respect for many decades. Anybody who ever looks at the UK economy always concludes that we should be more German in our approach to education and have exactly this emphasis on technical skills and giving the same amount of esteem and regard to people doing engineering and working on the shop floor as to people in universities. And it hasn't worked. They've been trying to do it for decades.
Yeah. China will try as well, I guess.
But it certainly seems like the consequence of a new kind of China when you say that people say that it is demeaning to work on the shop floor in factories. Presumably it's people's parents originally did that. I mean, all of this development has happened in very few generations.
I mean, absolutely. My father was a chemical engineer. And he did pretty well, in the last two decades, basically. Exporting pollution, polluting the air and exporting products and stuff. He did well, but he absolutely does not want me to go into engineering. He said it's tough work and he rather me, writing instead. The parents, they just don't want their children to go onto factory floor. And I think it's a sign that China is no longer really the typical emerging market. It kind of has emerged in a way.
Yeah.
And you're
part of the problem, it seems.
Yeah, exactly.
And the whole of China, I'm afraid, cannot all work at Bloomberg.
I'm afraid not.
Xuli Ren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Bloomberg's recently published a series of articles under the tagline of Race and Recovery, looking at how America's economic recovery is playing out in minority communities. There's some really eye-opening data and stories about life in different parts of the economy in this series, and the final article came out this week and seemed to me particularly timely. as the US central bank starts to talk about raising interest rates, and we enter what feels like a new phase of the recovery. Andrei Tata is a data journalist for Bloomberg based in New York, and he's with me now. Andrei, the data you pulled together for this piece with Christopher Cannon this week paints a fascinating picture of US household spending through this pandemic period, and particularly the impact that government stimulus money has had on particular parts of the population. So just give us some of the big headlines from those numbers.
Sure thing. And thank you so much for having me. So we got access to spending data for just over 10 million people, a constant sample over time that allowed us to really kind of look for those trends and changes in spending behaviors. And the thing that we really kind of struck us was just how much spending had surged, in particular among Black and lower income families. And we could see the very clear impact of those federal stimulus checks, in part because both of those groups, Black and lower income groups, are much more reliant on debit card spending. And we could see in this data just how much the debit card usage kind of rose around the time of those stimulus checks.
Because you're only spending what you have, you can only spend what you have in your account because you don't necessarily get credit.
Exactly, right? Whereas, for instance, if you look at higher income spenders, or, you know, which, you know, also will capture a large portion of white and Asian spenders, their use of credit is much, much higher. They were clearly, in this data and in other research, has shown that those groups were much more able to hold back spending, right, in those first few months waiting this out, which is much harder for those groups which live a bit tighter, month to month.
What kind of numbers are we talking about in terms of just the impact of the stimulus packages relative to what they would have been spending in 2019, say?
In the case of, say, spending by the Black people in our sample, it was up almost 40% this past kind of spring and summer compared to 2019 levels, which is, you know, a trend that would not be seen normally, you know, even factoring in just normal economic growth, normal inflation. That is a really significant bump up. And there certainly are other factors at play, but, you know, given kind of this, given the scope of that injection of cash really into parts of the economy, it was significant.
And across the sample, I think it was 25% increase in spending, which only came back a certain amount when things like the unemployment benefits ran out in the fall.
Absolutely. I mean, as of October, which was the last month that we had data for, overall spending across this group of about 10 million Americans was still up about 15% compared to 2019 levels.
We should just say briefly what this data was. Where did you get hold of these numbers?
So this data comes from a company called Affinity Solutions, Inc., which have been incredibly generous in working with us and often partner with the Fed academics to provide access to their data, which nationally covers more than 100 million debit and credit cards and has an incredible amount of depth to it. So, you know, it was really great to get access to this and being able to also use the data that they have, linking demographics and income into this data, which is a very kind of complicated process that they undertake on their end. So, you know, it really gives a lot of insights that otherwise are hard to get at that level of detail.
And it's so exciting when you get hold of a big meaty data set like this and to have it be relatively timely as well. It's only going through to October. And I have to say, you do a fantastic job of making it come alive with some really lovely, colorful graphics, which we're not doing justice to on the podcast.
Right. A shout out to Christopher Cannon on the graphics, who made all those beautiful graphics. I definitely recommend folks to go and take a look.
I mean, inflation poses a risk to this big increase in spending power, right? When we look forward to next year, are we potentially seeing this big improvement in particularly Black and Hispanic households' spending power being really hit by both inflation and potentially a slowing economy?
I mean, absolutely, right? So this really kind of that injection of that federal stimulus really closed a huge consumption gap and also showed us the kind of untapped potential, right, that exists in those communities who just tend to have lower incomes and lower access to credit. So both kind of the fact that now most of that, you know, additional cash has now been spent. And as you mentioned, inflation is going to begin to eat in to some of those core spending staple groups that just can't be avoided. Certainly food, certainly gas are ones where, you know, groups who have to go physically into work, who don't have a lot of ability to hold off spending or access credit, I think we will certainly see a tempering or even a full-on slowdown of this spending recovery, which, as we know, powers the vast majority of the U.S. economy. So, you know, it both has implications for the kind of equity side of the picture, but also just for the recovery more broadly.
Yeah, and it's certainly a lesson if you want to stimulate the economy and get people to spend, give it to poor people who don't have enough money to buy the things they want to buy.
There actually are some fascinating studies out there which have really shown, though, that stimulus money, if you were a wealthier household, you basically saved it all, right? So, I mean, really, it wasn't doing what it was meant to do. Of course, for reasons of, you know, of efficiency, the idea was to just give checks all around. But as you mentioned, I mean, this data really shows that you can get the biggest bang for your stimulus buck by really sending it to those lower income households and communities of color, you know, who kind of aren't being able to tap into their full consumption potential.
It's a difficult challenge for the Federal Reserve, though, right? Because they're supposed to be focused on both stable inflation and full employment. They've said they're going to focus more on everybody's unemployment rate, not just the headline rate. And of course, black unemployment is still quite a lot higher than the average for the rest of the country. But they're kind of weighing up, you know, inflation hurts poor people, digs into their spending power, but not getting those jobs created, not bringing down unemployment hurts them too. It's a difficult challenge.
Absolutely. I mean, and on top of that, there's also, you know, this strange moment we are in where we have, I think it's something like 10 million unfilled jobs, and yet we're still not seeing really that broad-based, you know, decline in unemployment. So it really does present a very difficult obstacle course for the Fed policymakers.
But also a fantastic time to be doing data journalism. Thanks so much,
absolutely,
Andre Tata.
Thank you, Stephanie. I really appreciate it.
Finally, at the start of the program, I think I promised you the future of food. Here's Hong Kong reporter Huan Ha.
It has a very nutty taste.
That's Malaysian entrepreneur Kevin Wu describing the perfect burger that he wants to put into restaurants and grocery stores.
So we added some spices to give it that kind of familiar beefy taste, the grounded beef taste. And we've added certain hacks like mushroom seasoning to give it that umami flavor.
And the secret ingredient?
We've powderized our crickets.
You heard right, crickets. Roasted and processed into a fine brown powder.
And then we mix it with other plant-based protein source. I think it's pretty tasty, especially when you look at the burger. It looks like a normal burger, smells like a normal burger, even sizzles like a normal burger.
Wu's the founder and CEO of Ento, based in Kuala Lumpur. He's an evangelist for protein made from insects, and he's not alone. Startups from Europe, Asia, and North America are joining the race for alternative proteins and say bugs are making their way to our dinner plates. It's the next big frontier for planet-friendly, sustainable protein after fake meat.
If you were to compare 1 kilogram of beef versus 1 kilogram of cricket powder, it'll require 12 times less feed, 20 times less land, 2,000 times less water, and emit 2,000 times less greenhouse gas emissions. So in its most natural form, insect-based protein, it has already high and rich levels of proteins and other macronutrients.
And in an Ento promotional video, taste testers who tried the company's cricket snacks gave it a thumbs up.
Wow.
Tastes like chicken.
Tastes like chicken.
Very crunchy, like chips and stuff like that.
They actually don't taste like crickets.
There's also a sustainability reason why edible bugs are on the menu. Constant Tedder is CEO of Fly Farm.
You know, protein is needed. It's going to be an increasing need as the human population expands.
His company is setting up industrial farms to harvest black soldier fly larvae.
You know, those needs cannot be met sustainably. And so insect farming has a giant potential to be able to alter that entire protein landscape, whether that use is going directly to humans or whether it's going to feeds that then go to animals that then go to humans.
Tedder and other industry insiders say insect protein is gaining momentum. The industry was worth just a little under $1 billion in 2019, and Barclays estimates it will be an $8 billion market by 2030. Still, there's a lot of catch-up that bug protein needs to do to challenge the plant-based protein industry that's now $30 billion strong.
The market has matured massively in the last couple of years.
Katharina Unger's company, Livin Farms, is building industrial-scale automated factories that grow and harvest the larvae of black soldier flies. The CEO says one of the biggest obstacles standing in the way of insect protein being accepted as food is the yuck factor.
I didn't grow up loving insects or loving the idea of eating insects. On the contrary, my hands were shaking when I was first doing it, you know, and I really had to also myself get over this concept of eating a larva.
Larvae is the industry's preferred term for what most people would describe are living, writhing maggots. So far, many of those willing to try larvae and other critters are young consumers looking to make planet-friendly choices. Here's Wu from Ento.
Our current segments mostly urban, affluent millennials who are aware about the negative impact that traditional agriculture and meat-based production has on our planet.
Some of the world's major producers are betting on that sustainability value proposition. They're now investing millions of dollars to help bring crickets, beetles, mealworms, and fly larvae to mouths around the world. And the market may not need that much prodding. Globally, more than 2 billion people already eat insects, according to the United Nations. Nearly 2,000 types of bugs are edible. And that's catching the attention of food producers. The company behind Chicken of the Sea Tuna, Thai Union, launched a $30 million venture fund to invest in alternative proteins. It's invested in three insect protein startups so far, including an Israeli company that's working on tuna from fruit fly larvae. Antoine Hubert is CEO of Insect in France.
So the two main trends are basically meat replacement and forced nutrition, cereal bars or energy drinks, which was the first market before it would be the first to grow, where it's more about performance and not about taste.
The company is building some of the biggest industrial insect farms after attracting millions of dollars in investments from venture capitalist and Hollywood star Robert Downey Jr. Hubert says the industry got a big boost when European Union lawmakers passed legislation this year to allow insects to be fed to farm animals. Last week, crickets were approved as food for humans. They joined mealworms and locusts to get the green light to be marketed in Europe. Lawmakers are also considering nearly a dozen other insects seeking approval to be sold as food.
Clearly, Europe is the more advanced framework there, which is then helping companies to innovate, to grow, to invest with the visibility, and investors there have a stronger insurance of success because the markets are there.
The company is selling burger patties made from buffalo mealworm protein that's being offered in restaurants and grocery stores in Austria and Denmark. Mealworm protein has a nutty, mild taste, and it's being used in baked goods and pastas. But the company's bigger business now and for the next few years is selling bug protein as feed for animals. Food giants from Cargill to Archer Daniels Midland are putting money into such initiatives. Katharina Unger of Livin Farms sees that as the low-hanging fruit, turning insects into pet food or as feed for farm animals and fish.
Our customers in the food and feed industry, they typically make six-digit losses on their food waste, disposing it at a cost to biogas digesters.
And new planet-friendly regulations to cut waste and emissions in Europe and elsewhere put insects front and center to upscale organic food waste. Unger's company has contracts to build three plants next year in Europe and Asia for food and beverage companies. Livin Farms plans to work with the likes of breweries, bakeries, and juice makers that produce tons of organic waste.
With our solution, they can produce higher value products that they can sell, so they turn their losses into revenues and into an emission saving process. We save about 70% of emissions turning the waste into insect proteins.
The bug protein will be sold to pet food producers, while insect oil and excrement, called frass, is sold as fertilizer. Hubert of Insect also sees more money and investment over the next few years for bug protein, and more acceptance by consumers.
So you will have thousands of insect farms in the world that supporting this more sustainable food system. You will see insect on the menu everywhere. It will be normal. You won't eat it every day, of course, but it will be normal to see it on the menu in the restaurants, normal to see it in the supermarkets.
The company's third factory comes online next year near Paris. It says that will be the world's largest insect farm in the world. For Bloomberg News, I'm Wan Ha.
That's it for this episode of Stephanomics. We'll be back next week with a special Christmas episode of Stephanomics featuring the one, the only, Larry Summers. In the meantime, if you like the programme, please rate it and follow @Economics on Twitter for more news and analysis from Bloomberg Economics. This episode was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. As we mentioned earlier, Christopher Cannon worked with Andre Tata on that report on US household spending. Special thanks also to Shuli Wren, Tom Hancock and Juan Ha. Mike Sasso is executive producer of Stephanomics, and the head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy.